Version number 12350, Flying Officer A.S. Anderson, Reel 2. Flying Officer Anderson, Reel 2. You were telling me about the relationships between...
Well, we were remarkable bunch because, you see, we had one Count of the Holy Roman Empire, Manfred von Schwerin, who had been a skiing ace for Austria in the Olympics before the war, and when the Nazis entered Austria, he came over and took British citizenship and flew with the RAF. Then we had several French Canadians, and we had several Czechs and several Poles. Now, how the heck they all understood one another when they were in the air, I don't know, but they did. They were very effective. And of course, Douglas Bader himself, who was a brilliant pilot. He really was a brilliant pilot. There are some people who have a reputation of being a good pilot. Screwball Buehling, he was a wonderful shot. He was in the Malta Theatre, Canadian fellow. According to the people who flew with them, they were fine on their own, but they were not good squadron people, you know, keeping formation and that sort of thing. The most notable example was somebody who was a very fine flyer and did have a weakness, that was Amy Johnson. I knew her. In fact, I helped teach her to fly a motorless aircraft glider. I was at London Gliding Club.
When was that, roughly?
I'm just trying to work that out. I wasn't there very long. She happened to coincide. It's so long ago.
How did you come to have to show her how to do that?
She came to the London Gliding Club specifically to learn how to fly an aircraft that didn't have. She'd flown everything else, and she was a wonderful pilot. I mean, she navigated terrific, a marvelous woman, but she could not land an aircraft. She couldn't judge distance. And she used to, as you know, a glider lands at about 15-20 miles an hour, or even less. And she used to come in at about 35-40 miles an hour, and then do what that instinct and all her training taught her to do, and pull the stick gently back, waiting for the thing to stall and sit down. Of course, it didn't stall and sit down, it went straight up to 100 feet. She pushed the stick forward again, fearing stall, and she'd go in a series of sickening swoops across the air. You knew it was next swoop stage. You've been there.
I know where it is.
You know. Well, anyway, she really had terrific difficulty with any sort of aircraft landing the thing. The fellow who could land it all right was her husband, Morrison. I never met him till after the war. But he was tight or sober, he was mainly tight. He could land an aircraft.
So how did you go about actually teaching?
Well, the thing was that I was, having flown before, you see, I could take her in the two-seat Falcon that we had there. And she didn't need any teaching when she was in the air. I mean, when I say teach, it's presumptuous of me because she had thousands of hours and I only had a few hundred. And as I say, the thing that we noticed most about her was the fact she simply couldn't judge a distance on landing. Just a peculiarity. She never broke anything. She was a very lovely lady. Very popular. We had an ex-IFC man as our instructor, a fellow called Harvey, H-E-R-V-E-Y. Charming chap. He had a charming dog, too. A Dutch Keithon. Have you seen them?
No.
They look like a small Alsatian. They're grey, and they have blackish muzzle and blackish tipped ears, and a tail like a chow. They're about the same size as a chow. And they are what the people in Edam and whatever else it is they make the Dutch cheeses use to protect cheeses when they're loaded on the barges. It's a well-known breed, cheese hound. It's the best-natured dog I've ever seen. You can pick it up with the hind legs and it will just go brrr and roll its eyes at you. Of course, nobody was very brutal with it. Nice dog. Well, who else was there of note? Nigel Tangy, who was then married to Anne Todd. I didn't know him, but he was towing an aircraft. I think he was working, earning a living, and he got an old biplane of some sort. And Anne Todd came out to watch one day, and it so happened we were in the same sort of area, and I had a car, and she didn't know it came on the rain, and so I gave her, you know, shelter in my car, and we got talking. She wouldn't know me from Adam, and I'm sure I wouldn't know her now. But anyway, I just met her while she was there. We had an extraordinarily mixed bunch. I've been very lucky in the people I've met. They've all been so nice. A fellow there called Dunn, he was from the East End, and his father ran an umbrella factory. And he was just going on holiday there for fun, you know, to learn how to fly a glider. And there was a big cross section of society that you wouldn't normally have ever met. Anyone you would know. If you go there now yourself on a gliding holiday, which I heartily recommend, you will find that it's very reasonable in price, and you will meet a variegated section of society, all of whom, in practice, are very, very nice people to know.
When you received your commission, was there a question of whether you went to fighters or to bomber command?
I don't really know. I've always just done what I was told. In the wartime, especially, the thing was to get on with whatever they wanted you to do. And I thought, well, when I get a commission, they'll let me fly. But no luck.
Presumably, you hadn't had any experience of
not of active service flying. No. Just routine, the long course they called it. You did a bit of everything, you know, mechanics and radio and everything else. No, that was the routine long course. Anybody would inform you about that. And I think, as I say, that air service training is still going as an entity. They would tell you what went on then.
So did your duty as RAF police finish then?
Yes, it finished then. But I ended up as DAPMSIB. But that was a lot of water in between. I, first of all, was with 148 night bombers at Cabrit, which is the south end of the Great Bitter Lake. Squadron leader Rainsford, Wing Commander Rainsford was our OC. And it was the two squadrons, 148 and 70, that shared this aerodrome. And there were two other Wellington squadrons at Shalofa, which was just across the way, so to speak, which formed this particular wing. And our missions were always, well, practically always, to Benghazi, where we used to bomb alongside the mole there, all the Italian and German shipping that was bringing supplies in for their desert armies. I actually got to Benghazi in 1941, and remarkable to state, they all the raids that we had done, which was about two or three times a week, on Benghazi's shipping, we had to hurt the cathedral, which was at the base of the big pier, the Molo del Cattedrale. And we didn't, as far as I could find out, even crack a window.
What was your particular role in doing these
just interrogation of crews. What one did was, one was based at Cabrit, and one was flown up to the desert to the advanced landing ground, where the aircraft were armed and refueled before the trip to Benghazi. And then on the way back, they would land there again, and if there was anything wrong, we would inform base that they had everything ready for the appropriate action. Yeah, it was strictly an interrogatory job. People wanted to know at headquarters, of course, as soon as possible, what the opposition was like, ACAC and night fighters and things like that. And, of course, what the results of the bombing appeared to be. In those days, naturally, we didn't have the modern appurtenances that enable a night bomber to see what it's done. There were flames and fires. You couldn't really tell whether something that was burning was really important or whether it was just somebody unfortunate whose haystack had gone up.
So this was really debriefing?
Yes.
British
debriefing, yes. Yeah, right. And then Rommel started to be a nuisance and took over the desert pretty well. Well, between, let me see, how many months was it? I think about 3 months. I'm hazy on dates. This was just before Rommel took the desert over. But in between while, I had been posted from my job interrogating to be security officer for the whole of the RAF, for the whole of the Western Desert, with the exalted rank of flying officer. You didn't get much promotion. Anyway, I wasn't looking for promotion. All I was there was as a gifted amateur trying to get on in the war.
And what were your duties as security officer?
Well, hunting, this sounds melodramatic, but there's nothing duller than waiting to chase a spy who may or may not be there. We did have one or two very brave Germans who dressed up in English uniforms and got an English staff car and an English uniformed driver and went around asking questions. But communications in the desert between units, Army and Air Force particularly, were so bad that by the time I personally had got to hear of some such thing, the only thing I could do would be to go to the senior personnel staff officer, Air Vice Marshal Russell, and he'd give me an aeroplane and the pilot, and they'd fly me to where the people were last seen, and I'd try and pick up a cold trail. It was impossible. Desert's a big place. Everything's camouflaged, and one side looked very like the other, and you got right up on top of them.
Did you ever succeed in actually capturing?
Oh, no, nothing melodramatic at all.
What was it actually like living in the desert?
Yes,
time?
You're not knocking anything down. Good place to put a war. I really did quite like the desert. And of course, as you know, the English have peculiar characteristics when it comes to wildlife. As I remember, outside Marble Arch near Tobruk, there were some red flags in the main track there, which was marked out because tanks have to sink into soft sand. And everywhere a tank would pass, they had pretty good markings to let them know it was safe. And there was three red flags in the middle of this track when I went up there. I got out to see what it was all about. Three quail's eggs. Some desert quail had just made a nest there and left the eggs. And some kind friend had put three red flags extraordinary.
Were you in one place, or were you moving around?
Oh, moving around, very much so. I was sent by Air Vice Marshal Russell, Senior Personnel Staff Officer, that was his title, his PSO, to Benghazi just after Christmas 1941. And I was sent to Benina Aerodrome outside Benghazi, and a fort that was about 10 miles inland from there, to investigate alleged sabotage or theft of government property. And of course, when I got there, as usual, the information on which the whole job was based was inaccurate, and all that had happened was it was Fort Regina was the name of the fort. And the aerodrome up there was in the crater of a defunct volcano. And all that had happened was that hungry Arabs had come up out of the desert to the south and seen a lot of cans with writing on, of course they didn't understand. And they'd pried them open, and it was dope for the wings of the canvas covered obsolete American. Italian aircraft, and the Italians must have lost at least two wings of aircraft there, because all that North African Mediterranean coastal area is heavy red clay, rather like Devonshire here, you know, volcanic, and there had been very heavy rains. And as a result, all the fighter aircraft that they had there, and they had at least two wings, were bogged down up to their axles. And there were rows of CR-42s and G-50s. The G-50 was the low-wing monoplane Fiat. And the CR-42 was the thing that looked like a Gloucester Gauntlet. And they were, of course, as was the Gauntlet itself, which we only used for weather reconnaissance, was completely obsolete. So I took a party of 12 men up there, and we sniffed around, and we found absolutely nothing to report except that the Italians had fled, leaving everything that they couldn't carry with them.
Were attempts ever made to organise any counter-spying?
Well, this was... I was very much on my own, very small beer. The only thing was that if something had to be done that urgently required attention, I could tell whoever was in charge what I thought ought to be done, and if he didn't like it, he could call headquarters, Western Desert, and they could call Cairo, and they would be told to do what they were asked to do.
Did you fly reconnaissance flights yourself?
Never as a pilot, no. I have flown as a second dickey on a Wellington that had to be fetched from the desert, having, as it were, broken down. But that was not active service flying. It was down well over the Delta.
What were relations like between the RAF and the Army in the Western Desert?
Well, we saw very little of one another. We had a report from our reconnaissance man who flew the Gauntlet, my headquarters, Martin Bagouche. That's MA-ATEN, Bagouche, BAGUSH. Now that's about, well, I suppose, 35 kilometres west of Mazamitru. And he came back and he said, you know, the weather looks all right. You see, no sandstorms threatening. And he said, I think there's a column of German armour he gave us the coordinates. So I said, well, I'll check with the army. And I checked with the army interior, and there were no Germans around there, no Germans within 50 miles there. Well, just to be sure, I'd go back and have another look. So our boy in the Gladiator went back. He came back and he said, I think that they must be Germans. And so I said, why? He said, well, they shot at me. I said, well, that seems fairly convincing. So I told the army again, and the army said, oh, no, you must be mistaken. You aren't mistaken when you get shot at, you know. Anyway, that's what they said. And then it turned out that he was right, and there was a general brouhaha, and everybody was running around like a chicken with its head cut off. I think that they got lost, actually, but it was quite easy to do in the desert. Anyway, they turned around and went back the other way, and we never had any trouble from them at all. I had a friend called Paddy Doyle, a Military Cross fellow, I think the youngest tank commander in the desert. And he told me of one instance where the whole B echelon, the support, the mechanics and spares and everything else of his particular regiment, was outside Tobruk. And they went for a walk in the night, you know, it's nice and cool in the desert. And came over a ridge, and there, by golly, was bivouacked an entire German B echelon, complete with tanks. So as quietly as possible, they took their departure at night. It was quite a tricky operation. And we were far away in the morning. But just lucky that the Germans obey orders to the whisker. They're told you go to here and you stop there for the night. And they go to there, and that's where they stop. If they'd gone over the ridge, they'd have run straight into our sleeping B-ish. Fortunately, it didn't happen. War is full of odd things like that.
Were you involved at all in actually intercepting?
No, I wasn't doing anything that you'd call interesting. I was on the edge of the periphery of things going on, like the Battle of Sidi Rezeg. You know, when you'd hear armour-piercing shells at the end of their trajectory, turning over and over, and if they don't hit you, don't worry. So, anyway, you can be, while not a target, and not actually involved in shooting, you can be very much in the battle without wanting to be, actually.
What sort of places were you living in?
We were in tents. You had a pup tent, and I was sensible enough to have bought a rubber mattress, an inflatable thing. But anyway, when Rommel rolled the desert up, I naturally had no more desert to preside over, so to speak, if you could call what I was doing there. And I went back to Cairo, reported to Cummings, he was Squadron Leader Cummings, who was security officer in charge in the headquarters. And he told me that I was at liberty to seek other employment, in so many words. And he said, I think I have what you want. And without more ado, told me to report to a certain address. North of Cairo, and I went there, and to my joy discovered that the Deputy Provost Marshal of the Air Force Police had been a squadron leader over me at the school in Uxbridge at the beginning of the war, and was now group captain. And the man who had been a flight sergeant over me, both in the school in Uxbridge, and I had met him in France, although he wasn't on the same unit, Tommy Thompson. Bill Kirby, K-E-R-B-Y, and he was the ex-boy from Halton, who was charming, wonderful officer. And he said, you come and work with us. And they said, you better get yourself some civilian clothes. So I did, and we were doing this job, the Special Investigation Branch, we were doing it for the Free French, the Free Dutch, the Free Greek, the Australian, New Zealand, you name it, anything that was free. We were doing the work for them because, as you can understand, to do detective work in wartime, which involves counter-espionage, counter-sabotage, suspected enemy aliens, mm-hmm. political suspects, cooperation with the existing civil forces, and so on and so forth. It's a little tricky. You have to learn it as you go along. Because we were not an occupying power. We were simply there at the invitation of the Egyptian government. And if we fell foul of some body we considered to be subversive, we would go to the Egyptian authorities and we would say, we think that your immigration laws have been violated, and would you care to look into our dossier? We'd give you the dossier, and I was usually the errand boy. I would see my opposite number in the Egyptian police. Never spoke Arabic to him. He'd been to school in France, as I had. We talked French. Anyway, he would look into it, and then he'd get back to my superiors and say yes or no. If it was yes, would I please continue with the investigation? Or would we please? And I would get the orders from my bosses, and I would go out, gumshoes, and with my papers as a discharged airman from the French Alsace squadron, Lebanese. And I was never had to use them, but they might have come in handy. And this, of course, leads into the story of the fall of Greece. The time when Crete fell and then the Germans moved into Greece, the only people who could get out of Greece, civilians, to a safe haven in Palestine, as it then was by being a near relative of a serving member of the Greek armed forces in uniform. And in practice, of course, what happened with a lot of young, good-looking Air Force officers, unattached, the hetairas, the Ouris, the ladies of pleasure of Athens, would go straight to the nearest good-looking officer they saw and say, I'm your wife as far as Palestine. And he'd say, what, for free? And we'd say, yeah, sure. And you get me there. So a lot of people, it's quite impossible to check identities. You're evacuating about a third of a country. Well, it wasn't as much as that, but it was a considerable number. To Palestine, it was impossible. It just weren't the personnel qualified to evaluate the status of the people being evacuated. And a lot of these girls were indeed what they purported to be, and some were a little something more. They were friendly to the enemy. And once they got to Palestine, the only way they could get to where the big money was in the Delta was by being a fully trained hospital nurse. You'd be surprised how many of these girls turned out to be fully trained hospital nurses. Anyway, we'd get a letter from Colonel Papadopoulos. That's Smith, you know, in Greek. Saying that they would write to my superior saying, we, the Greeks, are worried about Mrs. Flying Officer Petronikolaou. We think that she is bad egg. Would you investigate? So my boss would say to me, and come shoes on, and she said, I'd totter out into the blacklist, so to speak. And I discovered that she was indeed a Miss. What was her name? Good Lord. When the memory of names is helpless. Anyway, she was a bad egg. She had a wireless sending apparatus with which she was in communication with parties unknown in Alexandria and Crete and Athens, I think. Well, anyway, she would be investigated immediately by the Egyptian police under the system that I had outlined to you.
Yes.
And then they'd come back to us and say, yes, indeed, she is a bad egg. Yes, Miss Prelorenzo, I remember. And they would tell us where they were going to put her across the border, because their immigration laws had been violated, and we had informed them they would therefore put her across the border into Palestine, which was then mandated territory by the British. And we would have a reception committee ready to listen to what she had to say. And of course, in order to save their skins, these people were subversive, so friendly to the enemy, were very ready to talk. And we would